All right, this will be the Eighth Commandment, Part 15, which will be the concluding, yes, that's right, it will be the concluding message of this series. As we've seen with all of the previous seven commandments, especially when studied in relation to their commandments and judgments, which isn't very often done, as we know, but with the Eighth Commandment, as with all of the previous seven commandments that we've studied to date over, I don't know how many years now, when studied with in relation to their statutes and their judgments, there is, again, with the Eighth Commandment as well, much, much more to the Eighth Commandment than a simple reading of those four words, "Thou shall not steal." It's also been demonstrated that at all levels of humanity, there is probably more widespread transgression of this commandment than any of the other nine commandments. Now, don't misunderstand me. There's plenty of transgression on, as far as the other nine commandments are concerned, to go around. But there may very well be more stealing, from pilfering at the office place to, and what do you call it, at convenience store, shoplifting at convenience store, on the more on the minor side, to grand larceny in all of its forms, than probably any other sin as described in the other nine commandments. As I've pointed out, stealing is stealing. Theft is theft. Plundering is plundering. No matter by whom it's committed, whether it be by one or a collective group of people, as it is found in the mob or sometimes in the mob called government today. And no matter how it's disguised or sometimes justified by people, stealing is stealing. In other words, sin is sin, right? Or is it? Well, the Apostle John distinguished between sin, did he not? If you'll recall in his first epistle, I believe it's in chapter 4, where he distinguished between sin unto death and sin that's not unto death. And by the way, that distinction is not about capital crimes versus non-capital crimes. And we're not going to get into it. If you want to know, we'll talk about that another time. But that is not the distinction he's making when he talks about sins unto death and sins not unto death. Although that is capital crime or non-capital crimes, that is certainly another way to civilly differentiate between different types of sins. But what about when it comes to the Eighth Commandment? When it comes to "thou shall not steal," might there be theft that's worse in Yahweh's eyes than other forms of theft? What do you think? Could there be one type of theft that's especially grievous or deplorable to Yahweh? Now, the Bible, I'll tell you, doesn't identify any type or class of theft in such a way. But I wonder. Any ideas of what kind of theft I might be thinking about? God robbing. Let's turn to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3, and we'll begin with verse 6. Verse 6 and 7, it says, "For I am Yahweh, I change not, therefore the sons of Jacob are not consumed." You know, a lot of times that verse is, the first half of that verse is referred to or quoted, "For I am Yahweh and I change not," and they don't seldom do they read the last part of it and why he said it. He says, "For I am Yahweh, I change not, therefore ye sons of Jacob are not consumed." Hallelujah. Amen. And that's not the point, but I thought we'd maybe, you know, rejoice in the fact that he has promised that in spite of who we are and what we do as regards committing sin, committing transgression against any of the nine commandments, including the eighth, that he changes not and that we are not, as a people, totally consumed. But it goes from there. In verse 7, it says, "Even from the days of your fathers, you are gone away from mine ordinances," or a word that's a Hebrew word there that's really better translated statutes. So it would be, "Even from the days of your fathers, you are gone away from my statutes and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith Yahweh of hosts. But ye said, wherein shall we return?" Now, I'm going to stop there and comment on that for just a minute. It's first of all interesting that here God is saying, "Return to me." And the people are saying, "Well, I didn't know we'd left." By the way, there is that saying, if God seems far away, guess who moved? He's the same. He's always remained the same. He's always been there. He's omnipresent. It's not him that's moved. We've moved away from him. But these people didn't even seem to realize that they had, that there had been a separation between them and their God. Wherein do we return? We're already there. And isn't that how often like we are? But out of all, and going forward now, and we're going to get to the next following verses in answer to that question, out of all that Yahweh could have cited as the initial means for returning to him, what do you suppose was the answer that Yahweh inspired Malachi to respond with? Now, if we didn't already know the answer, and I think probably most everyone here does, but if we didn't already know the answer, if we had only got to that part, or had we been there at that time when Malachi posed the question for Yahweh, and the rest of it hadn't yet happened yet, the answer hadn't been given, if we didn't know what the answer was, I think that we might think that Yahweh would have had Malachi cite the first or the second commandment as the means of returning to him, or at least one of the Big Ten. But Yahweh's ways are not our ways, are they? And therefore, he doesn't always do things as we think he would or even should. And he didn't in this instance either. Verse continuing on, or let's pick it up with verse 7 again, and we'll read through verse 12 this time, paying special attention to the answer in verse 8. Verse 7, "Even from the days of your fathers, you are gone away from my ordinances or statutes and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith Yahweh of hosts. But ye said, wherein shall we return?" Verse 8, the answer, "Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring ye all the tithes unto the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house, and prove me now herewith, saith Yahweh of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven, and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit, before the time in the field, saith Yahweh of hosts. And all the nations shall call you blessed, for ye shall be a delightsome land, saith Yahweh of hosts." But there it is. God, the answer was posed, and God provides the answer. How shall we return to you? Out of all the things that Yahweh could have said, he says, "You've robbed me, and you need to start there by turning that around and doing as you should." But I can already hear some people objecting that they don't believe that tithing is a new covenant, to be a new covenant practice, and therefore this passage is irrelevant. And by the way, one of the reasons I believe that some people have come to that conclusion is because they've become heaven-minded under the new covenant instead of kingdom-minded, not realizing that God intends for his kingdom to be here on earth. That the goal is not just heaven, wherever it is, but it's what God intends us to be in doing, the business he intends us to be about as Christians now. And because most of Christendom has become so rapture-minded, so heavenly-minded, so future-minded in the relationship that the only thing they're concerned about is going to heaven, instead of kingdom-minded here and now of being the salt of the earth and the light of the world, that I think part of it, that's part of the reason that tithing has gone by the wayside. At least one possible reason for it. Here's R.J. Rush Jr. has some interesting thoughts regarding this in, again, the Institutes of Biblical Law. On page 273, he wrote this. He says, quote, "To abandon the tithe and to adopt the modern tax system thus involves a double theft. First, God is robbed of his tax," because that's what a tithe is. Matthew 7, or Malachi 3, 7 through 12, referencing the passage we just read. He says, first, God is robbed of his tax, the tithe. It is amazing, and here's the point, it is amazing how many church members today will insist that the tithe is legalistic and is done away with, whereas they will declare that the scripture requires us to pay our taxes to the state. End of that quote. And taxes, by the way, that require a whole lot more than 10%. A little bit later, he wrote this. He says, because man, as a consequence of the fall, sees himself as God, Genesis 3:5, he sees evil in relationship to himself. He will casually rob God and say, God doesn't need my little tithe. But if he himself is robbed, whether or not he needs that which was stolen, man is indignant and outraged. End of that quote from R.J. Rushdoony. How true that is so often with our people, and how well said. Okay, so you still don't believe that the tithe is a new covenant statute. Although I believe that I've proven otherwise in the past, and I would refer you to, for anyone who still or didn't hear the series, I would refer you to, that was three or four tapes, I think, in the very long series, Principles of Biblical Economics, that if you question that, I think it was pretty well demonstrated in that passage that it's otherwise. But so you still don't believe in the tithe or that tithing is a new covenant practice. Okay, we'll go with that at this point. Well, how about offerings? You know, there's this big thing. Tithing isn't a new covenant principle. How about offerings? Don't tell me you don't believe that offerings aren't a new covenant practice. Because in Malachi chapter 3, note that not only were they stealing from Yahweh by withholding their tithes, but also their offerings. Look at verse 8 again. Verse 8, will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithe and offerings. And so whether you believe in the tithe or not, certainly you believe, if you're even a new covenant Christian, you believe in offerings, surely. So withholding tithes or offerings makes one a God robber. And although it doesn't say it outright, I have to believe that it's worse to steal from Yahweh than it is to steal from one's fellow man. Although the ultimate punishment, of course, would be, if not repented of, will be the same for either one. Now, I don't know about you, but for me and my house, we're not taking any chances when it comes to God robbing. And therefore, I would rather also err on the side of overpayment than I would on the side of underpayment. And therefore, tithe on the gross instead of simply the net. Even though, and I've preached this many times, even though only a tithe of the increase or the gain is required in God's word, which you won't hear from many preachers that preach on the tithe. But for me personally, I've always been that way with me. I've never in the past, tithing was tithing, and that's where I began. It was always on the gross, and God's always blessed. So there's no reason for me to think that he won't do, that I should do otherwise when he's blessed on doing so. But it's not required. But I'd rather side on the side, err on the side of overpayment than underpayment. And often it's just a matter of priorities or perspective. It's interesting, someone once said, how $100 looks like so much when you take it to church and so little when you take it to the mall. That's a matter of perspective. Furthermore, if there's any question, although there never is because it's automatic having tithed every week since I was the age of 20. But if there were a question as to whether I had or not tithed on a particular week, if it came to me that did I or didn't I? I'll guarantee you, I'd rather tithe again a second time rather than take the chance, any chance of robbing my God of what is his due. Not his due, what belongs to him. Now, please don't misunderstand me in all of this. I don't tithe in any sense because, I have to. But first, to begin with, because the tithe simply is not mine. It's his. It is his. Leviticus 27:30, it says, quote, "And all the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is Yahweh's. It is holy unto Yahweh." And therefore, by tithing, I'm simply taking my hands off or taking out of my pocketbook or my bank account, whatever the case may be for us, taking my hands off what doesn't belong to me. What belongs to him? It's not mine. Secondly, I don't tithe because I have to, but rather to give. It's the perspective again. But rather, I don't, not because I have to, but rather to give to Yahweh and his kingdom work. It's part and parcel of the way in which I worship him. And I actually look forward to being able to do so. You know, it's sad when somebody is looking at, oh, I've got to do it. I want to keep this. They're missing out on part of the glory, a part and parcel of worshiping our God. It is a part of how we worship him. In other words, there's no coercion, there's no compulsion involved with it, but instead it's voluntary and it's spontaneous. That's how it should be with us. I also don't tithe because because of Yahweh's promise in Malachi chapter 3 and verse 10. Again, where it says this, it says, he said, bring in all the tithes into the storehouse, and there may be meat in my house, and prove me. The New American Standard says, test me. God is saying that. Have you ever thought of God ever saying, test me? I want you to test me and see if it doesn't work this way. And then he says, prove me or test me now herewith, saith Yahweh of hosts, if I will not open to you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing that there shall be no more room to receive it. End of quote. I've heard people say, I've had people write me and say, well, I've tithed and I've still got plenty of room. I haven't run out of room. You know, I think sometimes people don't realize that their room is already so full of blessings. They're looking for the wrong kind. They're looking only for part of the blessing. It doesn't have to be in financial, although God seems to do that as well when you're faithful to him. Not always at first. Sometimes that comes later over a period of time of possibly testing him, testing you to see if you'll be true enough to test him. But there's other blessings that fill each and every one of our lives, if we'll only look for it, that he certainly gives to us. There are other possible benefits as well. I've shared this with you in the past. But two men crashed their private plane on a South Pacific island, and both of them survived. One of the men brushed himself off and then proceeded to run all over the island to see if there was any chance of survival. And when he returned, he rushed up to the other man and screamed. He said, this island is uninhabited. There is no food. There is no water. We are going to die. And the other man leaned back against the fuselage of the wrecked plane, folded his arm and responded, no, we're not. I make over $100,000 a week. The first man grabbed his friend and shook him, and he said, look, we are on an uninhabited island. There is no food. There is no water. We are going to die. And the other man, unruffled again, responded, no, I make over $100,000 a week. Mystified, the first man, taken back by such an answer from his friend, repeated again. He said, for the last time, he says, I want you to know, I'm telling you, we are doomed. We're going to die. There is no one else on this island. There's no food. There's no water. We're going to die. To which his friend responded one more time. And he says, and don't make me tell you this again. He says, no, we're not. I make over $100,000 a week and I tithe. My preacher will find me. Now, added extra benefits, just in case you ever end up on a deserted island. You tithe enough and your preacher's going to be looking for you. But I don't tithe because of Yahweh's promise in Malachi chapter 3 and verse 10, although he's demonstrated that to our family time and again. But in other words, I don't tithe to see how much I can get out of it, but rather, instead, to see how much others can get out of it. That should be our attitude, because we want to worship our God and we want to bless and further the kingdom and God's people in the kingdom. Let me tell you, it's a blessing. It is a blessing, not a curse like some people look upon it, to be able to give to Yahweh and his kingdom and his people. And I hope you have the same attitude. Nevertheless, don't miss that to do otherwise makes one a thief of Yahweh. That still has to be part of the perspective. A God robber. And don't miss the gravity of that. In fact, look at verse 9. He says, ye are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. I wonder if that's not one of the primary reasons, along with everything else that's going on against God's law, but that this nation is becoming a cursed nation more and more. And most people can't even see it yet. But because, as a nation, we're robbing God of what belongs to Him and what we should be giving to Him willingly and joyfully out of a heart of worship unto Him. Don't miss the gravity of that, although I don't, God forbid that that would be the reason or the attitude that we do it. Or forget that according to Malachi, that tithes and offerings, according to Malachi, and there's other ways and other means that God would, but according to what Yahweh provided Malachi, tithes and offerings is where it begins in our returning to Him when we're not where we should be with Him. You can't help with that in mind. You can't help or at least I can't help but think of those two bumper stickers from way back in the 70s or 80s. And I've shared them with you before, but there was that one again that says, honk if you love Jesus. Well, and then somebody came out with one as a reply to that, and it said, tithe if you love Jesus. Anybody can honk. And so you can see why God would maybe say, hey, this is where it began. You've been robbing me. Let's prove your faith. Anybody can honk. Anybody can say, I love Jesus. Anybody can say, yeah, Jesus is my friend. It's another thing to put your money where your mouth is, isn't it? Here's something else to consider, that is that it is possible to steal from Yahweh even if you do tithe. That is, if you're tithing to those to whom it shouldn't be going. Let's begin looking at God's criteria for whom the tithes should be sent or given by turning to 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 17 and 18. Verse 17, it says, let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of a double honor. And it'll explain what that double honor is as we continue here. It says, let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of a double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine. Verse 18, for the scripture saith, thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn, and the laborer is worthy of his reward. New American Standard says the laborer is worthy of his wages. So the criteria here was, before we get there, the same idea is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 7 through 14. And I'll just read this. It's a little lengthy, but let me just read this one to you. Where it says, who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Or who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? I am not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? Or does not the law also say these things? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. And then Paul goes on and says, God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Of course he is, he was, to that degree, but here's the point. Or is he speaking altogether for our sakes? Yes, for our sake it was written, or principally written. He says, because the plowman ought to plow in hope, and the thresher to thresh in the hope of sharing the crops. If we sowed, here's the application. Paul says, if we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we should reap material things from you? If others share the right over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. By the way, Paul, people who don't want to have to give the tithe say, well, Paul wouldn't even take the tithe. Well, he wouldn't take it from the Corinthians while there. He simply allowed the other churches that he had been to support him through the mail, if you would. So he was being supported, just not at that time with the Corinthians. He goes on, he says, do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar have their share in the altar? So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. End of that quote. Galatians 6:6, Paul also wrote, and he says, and let one who has taught the word, this is coming from the opposite perspective, let the one who has taught the word share all good things with him who teaches. And so there's the principles. And from those passages, it can be ascertained that tithes and offerings should go, especially from the first one in 1 Timothy 5, that tithes and offerings should go to those who labor in the word and in doctrine. But that's kind of ambiguous, kind of vague, isn't it? You know, those who labor in the word, you know, does that mean just anybody? The NASV is even more so. Instead of labor in the word and doctrine, it says one who labors in preaching and teaching. Well, let me tell you, there's a lot of people today who labor at preaching and teaching, or with the word and with the doctrine, who never attain to it. You know, many who can't even get the biblical plan of salvation correct or right. So let me recommend that you begin there. If we're supposed to be tithing or supporting the church, the ecclesia, which is, when you really understand that, it's a much more all-inclusive word than church. But if we're to be tithing and supporting the church, the ecclesia, that is those that, as the word means, those that have been called out and saved in Yeshua the Christ, well, then let's begin by making sure it's the ecclesia, not just ones that claim to be the ecclesia, but that's truly the ecclesia that we're supporting. That is that they're teaching the biblical plan of salvation correctly, as found in Mark 16:16, Acts 2:38, Acts 22:16, Romans 6:3-4, Galatians 3:26-27, and 1 Peter 3:21. Let's begin there. If it's the ecclesia we need, that we're to be supporting, let's make sure it's the ecclesia, in other words. Furthermore, the tithe was and is for building and maintaining the kingdom. Now, if you have a perspective that the kingdom is in heaven instead of the kingdom of heaven, then you can say, well, God doesn't, up there in the kingdom in heaven, God doesn't need my tithe to support the kingdom. Well, not if you've got that perspective of the kingdom, but if you're looking at the kingdom as being here on earth, or at least that it's supposed to be here on earth, and that we're to be ruling and reigning and establishing his government here on earth, all of a sudden you can see why the tithe and the offerings are important for the sake of the kingdom. So the tithe was and is for building and maintaining the kingdom, or at least for those who are directly involved, who are consecrated to that end, direct or devoted to that end. It was for those like Ezra, who is described in Ezra chapter 7, verses 7 and 10. In verse 7 it says, "This Ezra went up from Babylon, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses, which Yahweh God of Israel had given." And then in verse 10 it says, "For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of Yahweh, and to do it, and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments." Note, he had not only prepared his heart to know the law, it says that, and not only to teach the law, but he was one who did the law as well. Because the kingdom can be built only by teaching the king salvation in Yeshua the Christ and the king's laws. There are a lot of people, again, I say that because that's where the tithes need to be directed to. Those who are not only teaching the king, but to those who are also teaching the king's laws. There are a lot of preachers, churches, and ministries today, let me tell you, and you already know this, that preach the king. But few who want anything to do with teaching the king's laws. And therefore the question is, are they really teaching the king? You can't separate a king from his laws. Turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 31 and verse 4. 2 Chronicles 31, verse 4, it says, "Moreover, he commanded the people that dwelt in Jerusalem to give the portion of or for the priests and the Levites." Now listen to this. Why? "That they might be encouraged in the law of Yahweh." The New American Standard is probably better there. In fact, it is better when you look at the Hebrew word. It says, "Also, he commanded the people who lived in Jerusalem to give the portion of to the priests and the Levites, that they might devote themselves to the law of Yahweh." End of quote. That was one of the principal purposes, other than from God's requirement upon the people as a part of worshiping him and serving him, as far as the purpose for it from the priest and the Levite's perspective, it was for those who were devoted to teaching the law. Therefore, locate ministries that are teaching the king, but also his kingdom, and therefore his laws as well. that are promoting dominion in the king's name rather than being dominated and trampled under the foot, under by the foot of man. And yes, I know that that limits what and who your support should be sent to. But let me ask you, so what's new? It's always been that way for people who have been concerned about where they tithe, where they send their tithe. But actually, there's more out there than probably that meet that biblical criteria than probably you realize. Again, it is a minority. There's no question about that. The majority is a majority who only preaches the king. It's a minority who preaches the king and their laws. It's even a smaller minority who teach the biblical plan of salvation and therefore really teach the king as he should be taught and the law. But there's a lot more out there than you may realize. Another way that a person, excuse me, although tithing might still be stealing from Yahweh is by delaying the tithe. In Exodus 22:29 in the New American Standard, it says, "You shall not delay the offering from your harvest or your vintage." You shall not delay the offering from your harvest or your vintage. The Hebrew word achar, translated delay in that passage, is translated slack in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 21, which says this. It says, "When thou shalt vow a vow unto Yahweh thy God, thou shalt not be slack. Thou shalt not delay to pay it. For Yahweh thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee." Don't be slack, and don't delay to pay it. Once again, bad enough to steal from your neighbor or your fellow man, but how much more so to rob from Yahweh? I don't know. The Bible doesn't really say, but I certainly don't want to find out. Do you? All right. So we needed to cover that as a part of this series because it certainly is something that, again, probably needs to be considered more carefully than all of the other aspects and statutes of the Eighth Commandment. But now as we end this series, let me conclude this series with the judgment for Eighth Commandment transgression. Or I should say, let us return to the judgment because it's come up with nearly all of the passages that we've already studied concerning the statutes. We've already seen that Eighth Commandment judgment requires restitution. However, we've also seen that the amount of restitution varies depending upon the class of theft, what was stolen, and some other factors as well. For example, if you'll recall, if a thief is caught, according to Yahweh's law, his judgment of restitution upon the thief, if the thief is caught with in possession of the stolen goods, he's required to pay back double the principal that was stolen, whether it be a sheep or an oxen or somebody's wallet or a tool or whatever it might have been. He would, if he's caught with it still in his possession, he was required to pay double, if you'll recall. But if he has either damaged, killed, or sold the stolen items, he's required to pay back 4 sheep for the one he's stolen. Or if he stole an ox, an equivalent of a man's livelihood, he's required to pay back 5 oxen, or the equivalent thereof. And we just talked about the reasons, the different reasons why there would be the difference in that. And again, one of the primary principal reasons being is that the ox represented a man's livelihood and the sheep did not. It should also be pointed out that under 21st century American law, that if the stolen goods are discovered in the possession of someone who bought them from the thief, the buyer is required to return the goods at his own cost. He's at his loss. There is, however, no such stipulation or provision in Yahweh's law requiring the innocent buyer to return the items. It's therefore considered a legitimate sale, even if it is of stolen goods, if he was not aware that they were stolen goods. On the other hand, I think it can be assumed that a purchaser of known stolen goods becomes an accomplice of the crime and is liable for all or at least a portion or share of the restitution that's required in any particular case. And I would suspect that probably both thieves, it wouldn't be a sharing, that God's punishment would be the same on both. If there were more than 2 thieves, they would both be responsible for paying 4 or 5 times as much. Or if a man bought stolen goods and was aware of it, he too would have to pay the same amount. Therefore, if you have your goods stolen, make sure that they sell it to somebody else so you can get twice as much. We also previously discussed the liability statutes of the Eighth Commandment and the differing amounts of restitution required depending upon whether the acts were deliberate or accidental. There was a different amount required in such cases. And also for damage incurred upon property that's rented versus property that's in trust, that there was a different amount or different restitution involved in those as well. But the point here, although there was a varying amount of restitution, the point is that judgment for any Eighth Commandment statute was always restitution and only restitution. And that's, again, the reason why man-stealing, as it's called, or kidnapping, as we call it today, a capital crime, is not an eighth, but a sixth commandment statute, even though the word stealing is used in describing that particular crime. Now, there are a few more passages pertaining to the Eighth Commandment, pertaining to Eighth Commandment transgression and the required restitution that we haven't looked at yet. Let's begin and look at, let's turn to Leviticus chapter 6. Excuse me. Leviticus chapter 6, and we're going to be reading verses 1 through 5. In fact, if you want to just listen, I'm going to read this to you from the New American Standard because I believe it's a little bit clearer, and in one particular spot I believe it's a little more accurate, as I'll explain. You know, I put off examining this first passage that we're going to look at. We're going to look at three more passages. But I have put off examining this first passage because I have been unable to reconcile Leviticus 6, verses 1 through 5, with portions of what we found to be true in Exodus chapter 22. Let me read it to you from the New American Standard. It says, "Then Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, when a person sins and acts unfaithfully against Yahweh and deceives his companion in regard to a deposit or a security entrusted to him, or through robbery, or if he has extorted from his companion, or has found what was lost and lied about it and sworn falsely, so that he sins in regard to any one of the things a man may do, then it shall be when he sins and becomes guilty that he shall restore what he took by robbery, or what he got by extortion, or the deposit which was entrusted to him, or the lost thing which he found, or anything about which he swore falsely. He shall make restitution for it in full." Now let me stop there, and that's the place where I believe the New American Standard is a better translation. In the King James Version, if you're reading from it, you'll see that it says, "the principle." He says he shall make restitution for it, the principal, and then it continues, and add one-fifth more. In full is the better translation, I'll assure you. I think they didn't understand this passage when they were translating it in the King James, and I'm not so sure they understood it in the New American Standard either, but at least they translated the word correctly by translating it in full. In fact, if you look up that word in that Hebrew word in an Englishman's concordance, you'll find that sometimes it's translated in King James and New American Standard alike as the sum, not the principle, the sum. So in fact, translating the principle is almost the opposite of what this word means. And so I think the New American Standard is better when it says, "He shall make restitution for it in full and add to it one-fifth more. He shall give to the one to whom it belongs on the day he presents his guilt offering," end of quote. Now note that this statute here in Leviticus 6 requires restitution plus one-fifth. Whereas Exodus 22 requires either 2, 4, or 5 times, not one-fifth, but 2, 4, or 5 times for what appears to be the same or similar transgressions, leaving us with what appears, emphasis on the word appears, to be a discrepancy in God's law. Now there is no discrepancy there, whether we can figure it out or not. It's just a matter of us catching up to God. But it certainly appears that way. And I have left that passage totally alone and have prayed about it, you know, because I just couldn't reconcile the two. In fact, I have scoured several different commentaries and have yet to find a satisfactory explanation between those two passages. And right up to the time of preparing for this portion of this concluding message, I didn't have any answer for it either. However, at the very last minute, I believe that the Lord has provided me with the answer, although, let me say, I remain open to other ideas on this as well. The only significant difference between Exodus chapter 22 and Leviticus 6 is that in Leviticus 6, deception is emphasized, or what might be called a cover-up, is involved in this in Leviticus 6, whereas there is no indication of a cover-up of any kind in Exodus chapter 22. For example, in Leviticus 6:2, it uses the word deceives. In verse 3, it says lied about it and sworn falsely about it, and then sworn falsely is again emphasized and used in verse 5 in Leviticus 6. And again, none of that is found in Exodus 22. And therefore, here is what I believe is the reconciliation. I believe that Leviticus 6, I believe that Leviticus 6 is elaborating upon the fact that if after being caught, the thief attempts to cover up his crime by lying or deceit, he is then to pay an additional one-fifth to what was otherwise required in Exodus chapter 22, whether it be 2 times, 4 times, or 5 times. So it was, again, a punishment. You're going to try to deceive the court, you're going to pay more. Rather, if you get caught, better off just to confess it. If you don't, you're going to pay more, is what I think the difference is. That's the only thing that I can come up with is a reconciliation between those passages, and I think that's the answer. And therefore, especially from the New American Standard, the restitution in full in verse 5 is referring not just to the principal plus a fifth, but to the sum, the principal and the 2 or 4 or 5 times. The principal would be a part, by the way, of the 2 or 4 or 5 times in Exodus 22. And then the one-fifth is added to it for the attempted cover-up. Anyway, you can look at those passages and see if you think that's a fair reconciliation. I have yet to see any commentary that got anywhere close to they tried, but there was no sense to the reconciliation whatsoever. Now, 2 more passages that also need to be addressed real quickly before concluding. Look, since we're already in Leviticus 6, let's look at Leviticus 5, verses 14 through 16. Verse 14, it says, "And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, If a soul commit a trespass and sin through ignorance in the holy things," you might ask yourself, what are the holy things? "Of Yahweh, that he shall bring for his trespass unto Yahweh a ram without blemish out of the flocks, with thy estimation of the shekels of silver, after the shekel of the sanctuary for the trespass offering." Now that's Old Covenant, because we know the sacrifice system has changed from the Old Covenant to the New Covenant. But verse 16, it goes on and it says, "And he shall make amends for the harm that he has done in the holy thing, and shall add the fifth part thereto, and give it unto the priest, and the priest shall make an atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering, and it shall be forgiven him." Now, here, note that the trespass in these 2 verses is against Yahweh in the holy, or what could have been translated the dedicated or the consecrated things. Such as what? How about tithes and offerings? The offerings, I'm sure that's what this passage is talking about. "Therefore, according to the statute, if you transgress in this area, tithes and offerings, if you haven't been faithful, according to this passage, you are required to make restitution with the original tithe, adding one-fifth to it." In other words, better just to tithe in the first place than to do it later when you got to add more. A fifth of the tenth. All right, now let's turn also to Numbers chapter 5 and verses 5 through 7. And we're going to see here, and again I'm going to read it from the King James, but we're going to find that this passage is once again addressing the same thing that we read about in Leviticus 6. And again, King James translates the word "the principle" when the New American Standard, as it should be, translates it in full. So I'll make note of that as we read this. Numbers 5, verses 5 through 7. And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, when a man or a woman shall commit any sin that men commit to do a trespass against Yahweh, and that person be guilty, then they shall confess their sin which they have done, and he shall recompense his trespass with the principal thereof, and add unto it a fifth. Now there's the principle of why, again, we should be, shall in full, shall with or his trespass in full thereof, and add unto it the fifth part thereof, and give it unto him against whom he has trespassed. So again, that part of it is the same as Leviticus chapter 6. But it's the it's what follows this that I want you to note especially, because it adds something to it. In verse 8, first part, it says, but if a man, tying into what we just read, he says, but if a man have no kinsman to recompense the trespass unto, what then? What if you can't find the man who you trespassed, who you stole from? What then? What do you do? Are you off scot-free? No. But if the man have no kinsman to recompense the trespass unto, let the trespass be recompensed unto Yahweh, even to the priest, beside the ram of the atonement, whereby an atonement shall be made for him. The point being of this passage being that in the absence of an identifiable victim, which can happen, you know, so let's say that somebody in his younger years stole from somebody and went into somebody's garage and stole some things as a teenager, and later he becomes a Christian and he knows that he still has these items he stole that aren't his and they need to be returned, but the people have moved and he never knew who they were and he has no way to return them. The point is that restitution still has to be made. God still requires restitution. One is still obliged to pay reparations, to make compensation, restitution to the one, in this case, to the one or to the ecclesia to whom one ties. God doesn't say you're off scot-free. You can't get it to the one who was harmed or damaged. Then you give it to the building of the kingdom for the church. Because once again, eighth commandment judgment always, always requires restitution in one form or another, even when you can't find the victim. Now, in closing, consider once again, and how many times we have seen this time and again through all of these commandments, once again throughout this entire series, once again, I'd like you to consider how superior Yahweh's system is. And in this instance, as it pertains to the judgment for stealing, as contrasted to our current or present quote unquote justice system that further penalizes the victim and other innocent people by taxing them to pay for imprisonment of convicted thieves. That is, if the thieves aren't simply released back into society to steal more again anyway. In To Heal the Nation by Franklin Snook, he wrote on page 162 the following. He said, quote, only a very small percentage of criminals are ever convicted and sent to prison, and even this small percentage overcrowds the prisons. One case was cited of a man who was arrested for armed robbery and released on bond. During the next 4 months, while free on bond, he was arrested 5 times on various charges ranging from petty larceny to car theft. Finally, he pleaded guilty to attempted petty theft and was again released upon to await sentencing. End of quote. It's a pretty good description of what normally happens. And why not? From the perspective of the thief, he's headed to prison, possibly. Whether he steals once or more times, the punishment is essentially going to be the same. Snook continued on the same page a little bit later on. He said, quote, fines paid to the city, county, or state, or a prison term for the criminal, does nothing for the victim and very little for the offender. Neither do the sentences often fit the crime. Actually, a term in prison or in jail cannot even be considered punishment. It may not be fun, and I've had prisoners, you know, that write me and say, well, it's not fun here. But he goes on, he says, it is rather a reward to the criminal for his crime. He is relieved of the responsibility of providing for his own shelter, clothing, food, and medical care. He is given total economic security at the expense of the law-abiding citizens, including his victims. End of that quote. But under Yahweh's system, the first time the thief steals and is caught and convicted, he is required to pay to restore. He's required to pay to restore what he stole, and in most cases, 2 to 5 times as much as he stole, or more. And if he can't pay, what if he can't pay? If he cannot pay, according to Exodus chapter 22 that we've previously studied, he is to be sold for his theft, indentured, until he has worked off his debt in full. And, of course, the money then goes to the one from whom he stole, the victim. Either way, the criminal is punished, and the victim isn't further victimized, but rather compensated for his losses. Now tell me, God's way isn't superior to what we've come up with in the 20th and 21st century. And note, there is no crime here against the state like the state would like to claim. And therefore, crime against the state. What is that? Well, it's a way for the government to build up their coffers a little more. Great idea if you're the government. But there is no crime against the state, and therefore the state isn't compensated. The victim is, under God's law. Furthermore, when we do it Yahweh's way, instead of 21st century America's way, tax-subsidized prisons are no longer necessary. And another burden, another tax burden, is removed from the people. To begin with, with what we have today in our prisons, a portion of the prison population would be set free from the get-go because they've been criminalized under man's legal system rather than Yahweh's lawful system. In other words, there's a whole lot of crimes today according to our government that aren't crimes according to Yahweh's laws. In many cases, there's no victim. And they shouldn't have been in prison in the first place. Additionally, another large portion of today's prison population would not be imprisoned, but would have been executed for their capital crimes as dictated by Yahweh's laws, which would then leave only thieves, who would also be released, and now you have no prison population, who would also be released to pay restitution or to be indentured. Great system. Great plan. But you can already hear the objections, can't you? But what if the thief refuses? What if he just flat out refuses to pay restitution or turns down indentureship? He doesn't want to do it. You know, what then? Imprisonment then is our only answer, or the only option left to us. Well, maybe to man's way of thinking, but not according to Yahweh's perfect law. Because if a thief refuses to pay restitution, that is, if refused to do as the judge has so ordered, it's called contempt of court. Or more properly, and I'd never thought about this before, more properly, contempt of Yahweh. And that's why it holds such a serious judgment, being that the court in this instance is simply an arm of Yahweh carrying out his judgments. And contempt of Yahweh or court, according to Yahweh's law, is punishable by death. Turn quickly, because we don't have much time here, or I'll read it to you as I'm already there. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verses 9 through 13. In fact, I don't have time to go there, but you can see there that is the punishment. Contempt of court under Yahweh's system was indeed the death penalty. You are to be stoned to death. How terrible! Well, only if you're a bleeding heart liberal who cares more about the criminals than you do the victims. That is, until you become one of the victims. Yahweh's ways, can you not see it, are indeed perfect. Psalms 18:30. And Yahweh's law is perfect. Psalms 19:7. I guarantee you, except in the case of some fella who has a death wish, when given the choice to pay restitution or die, that the thief will be glad to pay 2, 4, or 5 times, depending on the situation, of what he stole. And he will probably be unlikely to ever steal again. What a great God we serve. Amen. He's perfect. His ways are perfect. His laws are perfect. And His judgments are perfect as well. Now let me conclude this series. I want to conclude with that thought. I mean, because there's not a better thought than to realize, I mean, especially when you contrast it with how man has just messed it up, how perfect our God is, how perfect His law is, how perfect His kingdom, His government, and all of His ways are. That's a great thought. And a great thought that we need to take to our brethren and say, you believe that? Let's start practicing it. Let's start demanding that we have His perfect ways instead of man's imperfect ways that just get more imperfect as time goes on. And the things get worse and worse and worse because imperfection can only lead to more imperfection. Whereas perfect is already perfect and always remains perfect. But let me conclude this series with some of Solomon's inspired wisdom. For anyone who's yet, even after all of this in this series, yet possibly inclined to steal from man or from God. In Proverbs 9 and verse 17 and 18, Solomon said this. He said, stolen water is sweet. And bread eaten in secret is pleasant, that which you've stolen. But he does not know that the dead are there, that her gifts are in the depths of Sheol. Let me conclude with simply, do not steal. And may Yahweh help us to abide by His laws and establish them here in America someday, if not in our generation and in the generation of our children or our grandchildren, here as the laws of the land here in America. May it be so. May God use this series to help establish that, to help teach our people how perfect His laws and ways are, how perfect He is, and how blessed we are to serve such a God, to be under the covering of Christ our King, and to be able to then serve Him as King by applying His laws in the land today. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we are thankful to You for the fact that You're perfect, that Your laws are perfect, Your ways are perfect. And Father, we just ask that we would not only recognize that, Father, not only admit to it and praise You, Father, for it, but that we would do our best to help teach others of the same thing and be able to help establish, Father, Your rule here on earth, here in America, as it was once in an earlier time. Help us to return to Your perfect ways, not to that which was good, but certainly not perfect, by wanting to return to some man's constitution, but instead Your constitution is found in Your word and Your laws. Bless and use this series to Your praise and glory. We ask it in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.